This is an ABC Radio National podcast, and we have many more to choose from, which you can hear details about after this program. But right now, we hope you enjoy this podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Sports Factor here on ABC Radio National. I'm Mick O'Regan. Well, it's Rugby League Grand Final time, and the people selling balloons and bunting must be raking it in. Sunday we'll see the best two teams in the competition compete for the big prize. And this year's contest between the Manly Sea Eagles and the Melbourne Storm is posing an unusual dilemma for the legions of neutral fans. As people would know, it's a common refrain in rugby league circles that people follow two teams, their own and whoever's playing Manly. Now, it seems that the 1970s etched these animosities into memory. Manly were depicted as cashed up and predatory, simply buying the stars of opposing teams. And West, well, they were broke bogans. It was battlers against toffs, or in the lingo of the day, the Fibros and the Silvertails, which is the title of a new documentary on an infamous 1978 season.
We need to go back to the start to understand how the war between the Fibros and the Silvertails began. In the 1970s, Sydney is a city divided, east and west, north and south. Manly is a beach suburb north of the harbour, while the Fibros are based in the sprawling western suburbs. The west is Sydney's working class heartland, a place of sprawling suburbs and industry. But by 1978, it is a zone of high unemployment and low prospects. Manly, on the other hand, is where Sydney comes to play, a village on the harbour, a place of surf, sun and fun. It is how Australia likes to see itself, relaxed, comfortable and tanned. Wests have not won a premiership since 1952, and in 1978, they're virtually broke. They get a new coach from their own third-grade team. Manly have money and organisation. Over the decade, they've assembled a talented team full of internationals. They are rugby league's model team and have won three premierships in the last 6 years. At the beginning of 1978, Manly are the clear favourites.
The writer and director of the documentary is Paul Oliver, who's also a lifelong West fan. So to begin, I had to ask him, is this film a labour of love?
Yeah, definitely. The inspiration and the beginning of the film is my memory of when I was a 10-year-old listening to Western Manly play the final in 1978. I was so nervous that I couldn't actually listen to the broadcast with the rest of my family, so I locked myself in my bedroom, got my radio out, and being a good Catholic, I got my rosary beads out as well and started praying that referee Greg Hartley would make decisions in our favour. As it went on and on, the harder I prayed, the worse it got. But I really wanted to go back and explore that memory that I've had for 30 years about so many strong things of, you know, was I just a fan with sour grapes? Was there something happening? It seemed that in 1978, it was a real year when the whole thing to do with class conflict, refereeing controversy, and the whole thing about the Fibros and the Silvertails built up into a year that had stuck in my mind for 30 years and I think in the memory of a lot of people.
Well, look, we're going to come to that because, as you say, all those things appear to bubble to the surface. In some ways, other people have said to me that 1978 was almost an emblematic year for rugby league, particularly in Sydney, and that from 78 a whole lot of things to do with the introduction of video evidence and what would bring a player to the judiciary, all those things began to change. Tell me, though, about the two teams. So we've got Manly, who are dubbed the Silvertails, yeah, and Western Suburbs, who are very much the Fibros. Just give us a sense of how those monikers came about.
They were pretty much invented by Roy Masters at the beginning of 1978. By 1978, Manly had already won three premierships in that decade. They were a very wealthy club. They were seen to be the sort of new face of rugby league. They were media-friendly, a host of attractive players, and the club leadership was very well connected into the administration of the game. West, on the other hand, were Western Suburbs Magpies, were an old-fashioned, they were the old face of rugby league. Rugby league is a physical sport, some would say a violent sport, and Western Suburbs were certainly the old face of rugby league. And what was happening by 1978 is that TV broadcasting of the game had got so much better. There were more cameras, more angles, replays, slow motion replays. And what had really always been around in rugby league, the sort of brutality of it, I suppose, was now suddenly on TV screens across the nation. And the administration of the game was thinking, well, we have to change the game in order to make it perhaps more TV friendly. Manly were well placed to go with that. Wests, on the other hand, were going to bear the brunt of that change.
Now, was this the beginning of effective full-time professionalism? Were these players still working in other jobs and then playing football training two nights a week and playing on the weekends? Or were we seeing basically people who were part of their clubs full-time?
Compared to today, they certainly weren't as well-paid and as professional as rugby, as NRL players are today. Most of the players in the late 1970s still had jobs. They were sort of semi-professional. Tommy Radonikis, for example, owned a sports store. There seemed to be quite a lot of policemen and school teachers. So everyone had a job that was their main source of income, but gave them a bit of flexibility as well. And that was important for Wests because, Western Suburbs players were still seen to be part of the community that they represented.
And indeed, people like Tommy Radonikis, who you mentioned, really saw, it seems to me, watching the documentary, that they were gladiators for their community. And when they went out and played tough, they were representing all those sort of non-spoken resentments that Western Suburbs people allegedly felt about, their wealthier Sydney side cousins. Tell me about some of the players who really defined this Western Suburbs team, people like Radonikis and Les Boyd.
Tommy is he's a true believer even till today, and while there's a lot of unspoken sort of subtext why Fibros and Silvertails resonated with people in the West, Tommy certainly doesn't bother with subtext. He says it out loud and proud. They represented the people out in the Western Suburbs, the salt of the earth, the people who had to work for a living, and he really sets up the divide between those sort of people and people, as he says in the film, who were the latte drinkers down at the beachside. And Tommy, he's quite unrepentant that he didn't mind if the media or the powers that be were resentful of the language that West were using to do with class, or they were resentful of the violence they were using. He believed, and I think he was right, that the people in the Western Suburbs, West fans, they liked what West was saying at the time and they liked how West were playing the game.
At the heart of the tensions in the late 70s was the allegation from aggrieved fans that over years, Manly had simply been able to attract the best players by having the most money. The Sea Eagles were rich and successful, whereas the Western Suburbs Magpies hadn't won since 1952, were short on cash and sponsors. For Manly officials like Ken Arthurson, the antagonism meant preconceived ideas, but there was a given. You simply couldn't get past the facts.
The expectation was that it was going to be a tough game, although we were very confident because we knew that we were a better team than Wests, and there's no question of that.
They thought they were better than us. No, they didn't think they were better football. They thought they were better people than us.
On the way down, I was sitting alongside of an old teammate, Peter Young, the West front rower, and I had a suspicion that this game was going to erupt. Because I said, "G'day, how are you going, Pete?" And Pete said, "I can't speak to you, Nighty. I'm not allowed to talk to you, I've been told."
The plane was diverted and it landed at Essendon Airport through fog or some reason, and a bus pulled up. Now, there was a Manly player. Now, I don't think he saw Boyd and I get on the bus, and he was sitting behind us. And he looked out the window at the rest of the West bloke standing there, and he made some very disparaging comments about them.
He said, "Look at the rabble of shit out there." And Leslie Boyd was near going to fly into him then, on the bus. And Roy pulled him and said, hang on a minute.
Tommy Radonikis, and a very prosaic assessment of the way he imagined Manly players saw their Western Sydney rivals. But did the West players themselves buy the rhetoric that class conflict should underpin their heroics on the field? Were they really taking up the metaphorical cudgels on behalf of the downtrodden proletariat?
I think they were in two ways. There were the true believers. There were people like Tom Radonikis who heard what Roy said and believed it. And there were people, as Les Boyd says in the film, who at one point he went up to Roy and said, "Roy, I know this is all rubbish, all this class stuff, but I'm going to make myself believe it because it helps us on the field. So so maybe, you know, some of them were full-time believers and the other ones were believers for 80 minutes.
Well, let's go to the famous diatribe, because this is a game, it's basically almost an exhibition game where Manly play West in Melbourne.
That's right.
And Roy Masters actually makes the point that in Melbourne, a crowd educated and reared on Australian football tended to watch the flight of the ball more, and often wasn't so focused on what happened to the player who'd kicked the ball after he'd kicked, which you might mention. But he goes into the sheds at halftime and delivers a speech, and a visiting, I think, the AFL coach of the home ground comes with him and records Roy's halftime speech, and then tells people later on he's never heard anything like it in his life.
That's right. It was the beginning of the 1978 season. They played at Junction Oval in St Kilda in Melbourne. There was an AFL game, which most of the Melbourne crowd had turned up for, a soccer game, which a smaller crowd stayed for, and then a rugby league game, an exhibition match. And I think at the beginning of 1978, West were a very poor club, and this exhibition game really brought it home for Roy, who was the new coach. West didn't have the money or the infrastructure to support a class team like Manly were. So what did he have left? They were getting beaten at halftime. So he gave them a bit of a blistering speech. The players, even to this day, I mean, football players play a lot of games, but every player I spoke to in West remembered this address at the halftime point in an exhibition game in Melbourne 30 years ago. And the coach, the manager of the Fitzroy Australian Football Club, which was hosting this sort of exhibition festival of football, he came into the... into the dressing sheds, and I think he wanted to learn a few tricks of how rugby league coaches motivated their players. A lot of expletives and go out there and knock the stuffing out of them. And Roy was quick to point out they were in Victoria, and the crowd, and particularly the touch judges, who were local Victorian rugby league touch judges, amateur touch judges, they were used to Aussie rules. They would, when somebody kicked the ball, they'd watch the flight of the ball. Whereas touch judges in New South Wales would keep their eye on the kicker to make sure that he wasn't infringed upon after he'd kicked the ball. So Roy pointed this out. As soon as he kicks the ball, everybody's watching the ball. So go in and knock the kicker down, which they proceeded to do, the net result being that a number of Manly players left the field by ambulance at the end of the game.
So did you put it to Roy that, you know, this was basically an incitement to violence?
We did. We talked about that quite a lot with Roy. And while Roy sees that there's a difference between the game that was played then and the game that's played now, I think he sums it up quite beautifully in the film, where he says it was violence, but it was honest violence.
What do you mean? What do you think he means by that? I'd like to ask Roy too, but what do you think he means?
I think he means that what really got Roy going, I think, when he started coaching West, was the fact that there was an inequality between clubs that were playing on what was supposed to be a level playing field, an inequality in terms of the wealth and the resources they were able to draw on, as well as the connections they had with the administration of the game. And West was certainly down the sort of downside of that equation. So he saw that as the greater sin than what was happening on the field, what was happening out there in front of people. And as I mentioned before, it's really about rugby league has always been that physical, brutal game. It was becoming more obvious now because of TV broadcasting. But I think he just thought, well, we're just got to play rugby league how it is meant to be played. And what you can get away with on the field is what you can get away with. It's a fair tactic, and it's far less devious than perhaps what other clubs were doing.
Because it's interesting, Paul, when Kevin Humphreys, who was then the president of the New South Wales Rugby League, talks about it, that he didn't want all the video stuff to come in. He think the game should have been played in a way that a referee was enough, and there wasn't a need to have follow-up checks from multiple camera angles. It's almost naive, it seems to me.
Probably with today's hindsight, it does seem that way, but... as we've got some stock footage of Roy Masters in 1978 on a news report saying, well, if the rugby league are going to bring in video sighting of games, what they're going to have to do is, you know, videotape every game, and they're going to have to watch every game, and they're going to be, you know, able to sight people from every game. And he says it with a bit of a laugh, the reality being that within a few years, and definitely now, that is exactly what happens. Every game is scrutinised from multiple camera angles, even if it's not the game that's being broadcast on you know, as match of the day on television.
Paul Oliver, the writer and director of The Fibros and the Silver Tails, a documentary on the 1978 rugby league season. I'm Mick O'Regan, and this is The Sports Factor on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and online at abc.net.au/rn. Well, at the centre of Paul Oliver's film is the figure of Roy Masters, the then coach of Western Suburbs. To turn around the fortunes of his struggling team in a game against Manly, Roy Masters delivered the half-time harangue heard around the rugby league world.
The halfway point in the game, we were getting absolute toweling from Manly, and Roy stepped in and changed the course of events, which was eventually going to be the course of events for us for a couple of years, the style of play we played. Yeah.
The chairman of our club, Billy Carson, in a moment of great benevolence, brought the chairman of the home VFL club into our dressing room, where he had a tape recorder and he witnessed my diatribe.
He told us after, he said, oh, geez, he said, I've never heard anything like that. He said, I couldn't believe it.
I had a copy of it. I didn't need to hear it anyway. I could hear it in the grandstand. Everybody could hear it.
The then president of the New South Wales Rugby League, Kevin Humphries. Roy Masters is now one of the leading league writers in the country and a regular media commentator on the code. So, was he inciting violence back in 1978?
Maybe, but more so retribution than violence. There's almost a subtle difference between the two. Something that the Jesuits would ponder over.
Sophistry.
But basically, they gave us a bit of trouble in the first half, and I called upon our guys to retaliate in the second half, which they did do, and exploiting the fact that Melbourne's touch judges had no idea about rugby league. They seemed to be concentrating only on the flight of the ball, and right, that was what was happening in back play.
Right. You talk about the idea of good violence. What do you mean by good violence?
Oh, well, good violence in the sense that what is sometimes called by coaches controlled aggression, where you drive in hard, put your shoulder hard into the ball carrier, driving backwards, enjoy the enormous momentum of the tackle, the whoosh of air that comes from his lungs, the splat when he hits the turf. Those good, lovely masculine motives.
Which, of course, are hugely popular with fans, particularly fans at the ground. Roy, much is made in Paul Oliver's documentary of class struggle, of class conflict. Can I ask you, how important was that class analysis in revving up your players?
Well, the Western Suburbs players generally believed that they were perceived by the Manly people as second-class citizens, in the sense that Manly had the richer contracts. They lived on the northern beaches. They had blonde hair. They were silver-tails. They generally came from a more privileged background than the West guys. It was a perception, but it was also a reality. I believe it, and they hooked onto the idea.
Roy, of course, there's a celebrated scene, which I'm sure you've been asked about before, where the West players are actually slapping the faces of teammates prior to running on to build up their aggression. Was that your idea, or had you seen that somewhere else?
No, we had a trainer by the name of Dave Dickman who was mostly mad, and one day the players came into the dressing room and they looked very flat and tired. They looked as though they'd rather be curled up in front of the television watching some archaic football show by Rex Mossop or something. And I could see straight away that we were in for a troubling afternoon unless the players played with a bit more commitment and a bit more enthusiasm. So I said to Dave Dickman, the trainer, Dave, do something to warm them up, get them going, they're not right, and which he did, and that's how face-slapping joined the history of rugby league.
Absolutely. I found it, grimly humorous that some players were very aware that there were some members of West you didn't want to partner off with in that process.
Well, yeah, Warren Bolden often said that. There were 13 men in the side, and he would try and sneak away, but I made the 14th man, and I did find myself getting whacked a few times. But we tended to avoid Dallas Donnelly and Tommy because they were the most lethal.
Roy Masters, senior writer for Fairfax and the author of numerous books on rugby league. And I should acknowledge I actually misquoted Roy in that question. He said honest violence in the show, not good violence. On the other side stood Manly, coached by the man who would coach the Australian team that year, Frank Stanton. So, in the eyes of Paul Oliver, what sort of team were Manly?
I think that they were a very skilled team, and quite a number of the Manly team went on to play with the Kangaroos that year. Frank, of course, was the Australian coach that year. I think when the season began and West came out with all this class talk off the field and the sort of violence on the field, they were a little bit on the back foot. But I think his strength as a coach, which was really, you know, Max Krilic and Graham Eady just couldn't, you know, were full of praise for Frank Sten. The way he just rammed home to Manly, keep disciplined, don't listen to what they're saying, don't react to the violence. Because, I mean, as Roy says, the whole West tactic was go out there in the first 5 minutes, have a bit of biff. The opposition are going to be thinking about payback for the next 80 minutes. We get the biff out of the way and then we play football and we beat them. I think Frank was a good enough coach that he woke up to that and just, you know, rammed home an iron-fisted discipline among the team.
And, of course, that disciplinary approach also affected the way the game would be refereed. And this is the third, I think, element of 1978, which makes it so interesting. It's the role played by Greg Hartley, who as a referee really becomes part of the drama, particularly with key mistakes in key games.
That's right. I think by the middle of 1978, the rugby league were getting, the administration of the game were getting a real battering in the press about all the violence and the constant sort of, you know, hits in black back play and punching and fights and all in brawls and everything. So they reacted to it two ways. One was to bring in post-game video sighting of players, of which the West Manly game was the first incident. And the other one was to bring in referees who would deal with the violence in a more sort of thorough way on the field, and to send down referees to lower grades if they didn't deal with the violence. So the referees are really churning through the ranks by the middle of the season. The one who comes to the top is Greg Hartley. He's very flamboyant. He speaks his mind and he's very, you know, he's out there to enforce discipline on the field, which is why he sort of rises to the top during the later half of 1978.
Tell me about the critical mistake, though, that drew so much controversy to him.
It happened, there's a number of mistakes. The first, as we get to the finals season in 1978, there's the infamous Manly and Parramatta semi-final, the replay of that semi-final, in which there are seven tackle counts. In rugby league, you're allowed six tackles before. In 1978, you had to, a scrum was called. Now, on several occasions during that Manly and Parramatta game, the referee, Greg Hartley, as he admits today, he miscounted tackles.
Which in rugby league is crucial because it means that rather than turning the ball over to a kick and allowing the opposition then to have it, you keep the ball for an extra play. And the controversy was that Manly, of course, scored, didn't they, off the last play off the extra tackle.
That's right. On 1-7 tackle play, Manly put up a bomb on the last play, the play that they shouldn't have had, and they scored a match-winning try. This, of course, again goes to the sort of perhaps naivety of the game at that time. No one realised until after the game, a Parramatta supporter was sitting on the hill at the SCG, and for some reason she counted tackles. She got home, she watched the game on TV that night, confirmed her count, and then rang up the papers. They didn't believe her. And that until they watched the game themselves, and then the headlines were, you know, Blacktown woman spots extra tackle in match of the day.
She probably went on to be a TV executive. but it's interesting too, because, I mean, they wanted the game not to stand because of the fundamental nature of the error and what it had done to the scoreline.
Yeah, absolutely. Parramatta wanted the game annulled. They went to the judiciary. They wanted the game replayed. That was knocked back. And you can see the case, you know, for and against. Mm. West, of course, was set to play the winner of that semi-final. What they wanted was the referee change because mistakes had been made, but the decision to sort of appoint the referee had already been made and the league weren't going to reverse that. So Greg Hartley went on to referee the Manly West game, which is sort of the hub of the film, the sort of the climax of our film. And while there were no seven tackle counts in that game, there was a little bit of controversy about West had two tries disallowed, and that was the sort of difference on the day.
Two disallowed tries. Such is the battler's lot. In spite of the loss, the one thing that the club couldn't control was the relentless move to amalgamation that finally saw Western Suburbs join Balmain to form West Tigers. And while Balmain may no longer be the centre of working class life in Sydney that it once was, there's no doubt that the team culture forged at Lidcombe Oval had struck a deep bond with diehard Magpie fans.
Nobody likes to be put down, and that's what it was like with us. And I know it comes to, what do they call that, social warfare or whatever you call it, you know, but anyway, so be it, you know.
People still used to hate them. They used to hate the Manly for what they stood for. You know, they had all the money and that sort of thing.
It was a great motivation ploy by Roy, you know, and he never stopped in the papers, never stopped.
Even in the official team photo, they had their jerseys on. Some of them were faded, they had tracky dacks. Tommy didn't have all his teeth in, and they traded on this us versus them mentality. It was like a class war, and my God, that really worked.
We became popular with all sorts of people. We became popular with, you know, guys in Long Bay Jail and things like that. You know, we got that sort of, you know, that sort of edge to our support.
It got to the stage where West supporters dressed down for games in order that they would not be deemed to be too privileged in their attire. There was a pharmacist at Burwood who actually would race home if we played on Saturdays and change out of his suit into a boiler suit and come and stand on the hill with the slats of fibro nailed together at the base and form a V, which he would open and close whenever we scored a try.
Why the fans loved it, because they were in the same way. They was in the working class area around the western suburbs, lid come all the factories and all that, and they loved it. They said, hang on a minute, we're not living down the sea at Manly or at the eastern suburbs, sitting there drinking our coffee and espresso coffee and whatever. We're here doing the hard yards. And that's why the crowds, we couldn't fit them into Lidcombe Oval. You had to sit around the bike track. They could associate with us what we were about. And that's why they loved us. Whether we right or wrong, they didn't care less.
Tommy Radonikis getting the final word. The Fibros and the Silvertails goes to air on ABC TV, that's ABC One, on Thursday, the 9th of October at 9:35. Finally this week on The Sports Factor, a tribute to the man widely hailed as the historian of surfing in Australia, Peter Troy. Sadly, Peter died this week. He spent a lifetime in love with the ocean, especially with the waves that could propel him through the water. In 1956, surfing was an exhibition sport at the Melbourne Olympics, and down at Torquay, Peter Troy demonstrated riding a rescue board to thousands of people. But, as he told me on this show in 2006, the real exhibition came from the visiting American board riders.
I distinctly remember being under the Torquay Surf Club, which was an elevated building up on lampposts, and they had all of the surf craft underneath, and I went under there to get something, and here was one of these American guys, and he was kneeling in the sand, and he was wrapping around a fin that he'd taken out of a little handbag that had his towel and bathers and everything in it. And he was wrapping newspaper around the edge and putting it into a slot in the surfboard. He picked up a piece of rock that was in the sand and he was hammering this fin into the surfboard. And of course, I had no awareness of what this was about, so I was interested. I hadn't had the opportunity of ever talking to the guy, so I was just looking at him and followed him down the beach, and there was probably 8 or 10 other people on the beach that followed this guy down, carrying the surfboard under his arm, and got into the water. So maybe it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm not quite sure, and lay on it. And, of course, we looked at that and thought, well, he's not very proficient because he can't even kneel on the surfboard, he's lying on it. And then we thought he wasn't very good either because he only went 40 or 50 metres off the beach. And that was the last time we thought like that, because immediately he turned around, caught a wave in about 3 paddles, stood up and crossed the wave and then hot-dogged backwards and forwards, walking up and down the board, and we were all just
gobsmacked.
Exactly.
Sharing a laugh with the late Peter Troy, a man who made an extraordinary contribution to surfing in Australia and around the world. Our thoughts are with his family. And that's it for The Sports Factor for this week. Thanks to Andrew Davies for producing the show and to Peter McMurray for technical production. Thanks also to Sabrina Lipovich in ABC Radio Archives. The webpage has all the details you'll need on downloading the audio, getting a transcript or listening online. abc.net.au/rn/sportsfactor. There's also an online guestbook and a place where you can send us an email. All comments welcome. I'm Mick O'Regan. Thanks for listening. I look forward to your company again on The Sports Factor here on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to another Radio National podcast.
And now you've got a chance to have your voice heard on Radio National's Encounter program by going to pool.org.au. Pool is Radio National's new collaborative online site where audiences become makers. The Art Heart Project asks the artist amongst you what happens when you create. Is inspiration a religious experience for you? Do you have a muse? If you're a composer, performer, dancer, writer, we'd love you to show us how spirituality influences your work. The best contributions will also be featured on the Encounter website or broadcast in a program later this year. For all the details, go to pool.org.au and look for Art Heart.